Hi, my name is Gary Myers.
And I'm Marilyn Stewart.
And we're the hosts of the Answering the Call podcast, the podcast about people who are answering God's call.
Today I am talking with Dr. Bill Warren. He is the director of the NOBTS Center for New Testament Textual Studies. And we're going to be talking about Greek manuscripts, what they are, what they mean, and why they show that the New Testament is reliable.
Here's Dr. Warren.
Okay, thank you for being here today, Dr. Warren, and this is Dr. Bill Warren. You are a professor of Greek and New Testament here at NOBTS, and you are the director of the Center for New Testament, New Testament Textual Studies.
Correct. Thank you for inviting me, and it's great to be with you.
And so we're going to talk today about something that I think is very exciting. And this is a field that is now growing. This is dealing with the New Testament manuscripts. And so I want to start with some of the very basics in case some of our listeners do not know.
Okay.
But when we say a manuscript, a New Testament manuscript, what exactly do we mean by that?
Yeah, the basic definition is a manuscript is a handwritten copy. Of the text, or it could be the original, for that matter. That would still be a manuscript, but it's handwritten versus a printed item.
Okay.
And so the manuscripts, by and large, go up. Most of them go through the 16th century. We do have some 17th, 18th, but those are less common because of the printing press having been in place by then.
Okay. And these are generally made from papyrus, a plant, or made from parchment. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Okay.
The earlier ones tend to be on either papyrus or parchment. We actually have 3rd century parchment manuscripts on the New Testament, as well as papyrus manuscripts going back to 2nd century.
Okay.
2nd century on the papyrus, those pretty well play out for New Testament by about the year 800. And there are still items used where papyrus is used up until around 11th, 12th century in some of the Middle Eastern settings, but we don't have any New Testament papyrus manuscripts then.
Okay.
On the other hand, leather parchment, that's what we're talking about when we
yes.
talk about one. Papyrus comes from a plant, grows in swampy areas like the Nile Delta.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the biggest area was. And sugarcane is what people should think of in our setting.
Oh, that makes sense.
And so you it's cut the middle out of it, and the inside is a nice soft item. And you can use that, cut it into strips, but you're going to have sugar in it. Papyrus, same way, you got sugar in it.
Okay.
On the papyrus plant. They'll grow to, normally they're going to cut them by the time they get 8, 12 feet tall. They can grow taller, but that'd be pretty normal for cutting. And then you cut the heart out of it, and you get some strips out of that heart. But you're going to have to soak it in water for quite a while before it's going to be ready to use. And the more you soak it and get the sugar out of it, the less brittle it will be.
Oh, okay.
Because that sugar, when it hardens, makes it brittle. So they use some of it just for wrapping paper where they don't worry about getting too much of the mm-hmm. sugar out. And so they have different qualities. The parchment ones go from 3rd century. We know of them earlier, but as far as New Testament. And they go up till 11th century.
Okay.
And after that, we still have leather used. Those are capital letters. We still have leather use. But paper comes into play. And a lot of people don't realize about 20% of our New Testament manuscripts are actually on paper.
Oh,
because
see.
Paper comes okay. into use in the Middle Eastern context, Eastern Church, by pretty much 11th century is being used. So
this is the reason I even mentioned that is that I think a lot of people don't realize that we don't have manuscripts from the very first century, that they begin
right.
probably in the second, and then they're on lots of different writing materials, and some of these are fragments. Some
yes.
are whole books, some are the entire New Testament. But the reason for that is all of everything you just mentioned, that writing was copying on material that was precious. It wasn't plentiful. And anybody that's been around a flood or just tried to keep things over the years understands, especially here in New Orleans, we understand floods, that things don't last. And so we have copies, and these copies are very important. Anyway, that was some interesting information there that I hadn't heard before. So when we talk about how many manuscripts we have, that number is kind of hard to pin down, but we have at least 5,000 Greek manuscripts.
Yeah, if you just went by total numbers, when we talk about Greek ones, we're talking about sometimes we divide them by writing material.
Okay.
So we have some papyrus, and then we divide also by types of writing.
Okay.
Some are written in capital letters, and it's like a printed capital letter, letter by letter.
Okay.
Others are written in cursive style, and they had the cursive style since way before the New Testament, but they don't solidify it for literary works until around 8th, 9th century, 9th century, we begin with New Testament manuscripts. And that takes over because there's a lot faster writing.
Yes. Okay.
And so we have the writing styles and such. And so we get all of these together, but sometimes we get different pieces of the same manuscript found at different times.
Okay.
And so while the official number would be closer to 5,800, rounded off, we can back that off some.
Okay.
And we're probably a little closer. Some of these are church documents, lectionaries for readings in churches.
Sure.
We can back it off to probably closer to 5,500.
All right. And the number is not as important as what is contained in what we have. But the number is important in a sense that it shows us just how many manuscripts we have.
Yeah, actually, I like the way one writer has phrased it, and I'm not positive it was original with that writer, so I'll just say in general that we have an embarrassment of riches with how many manuscripts that we have. And the sad thing is we haven't even studied all of them.
Because
we need more people working in the field.
It's
and there's a lot of work to be done in the field still.
People think it's exciting.
All totally done, but it's not at all.
And something else is going on is that these things, these manuscripts are being digitized.
Yes.
And so now if you come here to study, you can access manuscripts that are not necessarily here, but that you are able to see this in, this wealth of information that we have.
Yeah, there's actually an international effort to digitize as many as possible. Some are put online by libraries. Some are put online by a central setting that is in Germany.
Okay.
And we have the virtual manuscript room there. And so it allows access to all of these. And so then we keep studying. The other thing people don't realize is we're still finding more.
Yes.
The age of finding manuscripts is not in the past.
Right.
And so we keep adding, for example, the number of papyrus manuscripts. It has grown by more than 50% in the last 30 years.
My goodness, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that we are finding more, such as in the Middle East, that's a very dry climate, and they can be found in caves like the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so that preserves them in a way that wouldn't preserve them if they stayed here in New Orleans. So this is a very exciting time. And this is important to understand what we have, because we do have detractors that say these copies are not reliable. But all of these things, the work you're involved in, the work the center is involved in, and many other centers, that all goes to the heart of why we can consider the New Testament very reliable. One of the books that I know that you use in class is Myths and Mistakes in New Testament Textual Criticism, edited by Elijah Hickson and Peter Gurry.
Yeah.
And this is a great book. It's easy to read. It tells why we can have confidence in our manuscripts. And I think they use the phrase in there that it's the number of manuscripts we have, very large, very stable, and even early compared to other ancient texts.
Yes.
So, but let's talk about why there are so many, that they have been copied by hand. And so as you copy, we find that there are some differences. What do we mean by variant, and what should we know about variants?
Technically, a variant is any difference between two given copies of a given work.
Okay.
And so any hand-copied work that has any length to it at all is going to have variants when you make hand copies.
Okay.
It may be a spelling difference, and somebody hears the word and they spell there, and maybe they spell it T-H-E-I-R or they spell it T-H-E-R-E.
Okay.
But in the context, you know which one is meant.
Right.
Because it's not going to be hard to figure out what it should have been. Or perhaps they simply don't know how to spell something quite right, and they spell it like it sounds because they want to get on with the copy.
Okay.
And so spelling differences are the number one issue on variants. But most of them make no difference.
Yes.
As far as knowing what the text is about.
Okay.
So we eliminate those, and we've eliminated over half, maybe even 60-70% of all the variants right away.
Okay. If anybody's ever tried to copy something by hand, like I know nobody here has ever copied homework, but it's very easy to make those
mistakes.
Yes.
Or maybe you pass over a word.
Okay.
In the Greek language, you also have some grammar items that come into play. Maybe you fix the grammar or maybe you change it. None of these are really content-oriented in a major way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're easy to spot, especially with enough copies. You can pretty well tell where these originated. And knowing the trends that happen along the way on how the grammar is moving forward, you can sometimes even time-wise say, well, this doesn't come in until this time. And sure enough, there's the manuscripts, and it's happening at this point in time. And so you can tell the difference. And so that's one of the biggest issues, vowel differences, that type thing. They sound alike, so they mix them up, and it makes no difference. If you're reading the text out loud, and we have to remember, most of these texts for church use are read out loud. They're not read privately.
Okay.
And if you read it out loud and it sounds the same, nobody even hears the variant.
Right. And they're not concerned with those little...
No, they don't hear it at all because it sounds like what they know it's supposed to be saying or how they know it ought to fit within the larger context. We sometimes have people skip a line accidentally. Maybe they have two words at the end of the same line, and when they re-ink their pen, because they're having to re-ink their pen, no ballpoints or anything like that, so they got to re-dip their pen, maybe they look and they pick up the wrong word, and they may skip a line. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they go backwards and they repeat a line.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the type things that are common, everyday type issues. And those are not the ones that give us difficulties on trying to figure out what the real text was.
Yes.
Because that's where the abundance of manuscripts helps us.
Yes. All right. So just to kind of recap just on that, this is why us having so many Greek manuscripts is such an advantage.
Yes.
And this is more than any other ancient text, and it doesn't necessarily go to the heart of whether it's a true document, but it does definitely go to the heart of why we can call it reliable.
Yeah.
And of course, we know, those are two different questions, but right now we are talking about the reliability, and having so many is very important. You also mentioned that they're easy to spot, and that is true for most of the variants, am I right? That they're pretty
easy. When you read through manuscripts and you have a text to compare it with, you can spot right away where is it different, where is it alike.
Okay.
And so that's what we put together, and that becomes the foundation for weighing then what text should we print.
At NOBTS and Level College, our mission is to prepare servants to walk with Christ, to proclaim His truth, and to fulfill His mission. If God's calling you to take your ministry a step further, let us help. Visit us at nobts.edu.
I ran across this. Dan Wallace, a New Testament scholar, has kind of used this example, and Americans will know this, that the preamble to the Constitution that begins with, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union." He said if you picked up a copy and it said a more perfect onion, that would be what we would call a typo, but automatically you know, well, that's nonsense, and you recognize that it's just a mistake in the text itself. So, all right?
Yeah, believing that the text is reliable doesn't mean we have infallible scribes.
Yes.
We do not have scribes who don't make mistakes. We are human beings. The scribes were human beings. And the wonder of our text is that, but we can get back to where the text came from.
Yes.
And so having this wealth, the scribes being human, we shouldn't be bothered by that.
Yes.
God works through us today, even though we're very fallible and human. And the greatness of God is never dependent on our perfection or not.
Absolutely.
And so that's where we trust the text, because there's a God who inspired it and is behind it. And we work through the human issues in order to assure that we have as accurate a text as possible.
And I think many people maybe sitting in church have not heard about these different issues and the manuscripts and what we do have and maybe what we don't have, but that it is very reliable. They simply read their Bible. However, people need to be aware of this, if for no other reason but for the fact that we have now study Bibles, and many of those will note that maybe they'll find a note at the bottom that says earlier manuscripts do not include this, or they use this word. And so it's important to understand these issues.
Most Bibles have those notes now.
Yes.
And they need to.
Yes.
They should.
I think
we want to be honest about our text. We're not going to stick our head in the sand and say, well, there's no differences.
Yes.
We actually are going to say, God has blessed us with this richness.
Yes.
And many times these readings, even if they're not original, they help us to know what the earliest Christians, first two, three centuries of the church, were thinking about the text.
Yes.
Because most of these, if they're more than a spelling difference or grammar issue, they're trying to clarify the text.
Mm-hmm.
And so they show us early understandings of the text. And many times those are the best understandings we get on early commentaries.
Now, I want to come back to that in a moment about copies of copies, but I want to include a statement here from Bart Ehrman. And he is a detractor. He is a New Testament scholar, a very fine scholar, but he is not a believer. And he talks a lot about these variants, the differences between manuscripts, and has gotten a lot of mileage out of this. But this is from a book that is a textbook that he wrote that is used in colleges. It is The New Testament, A Historical Introduction to the Early Christian Writings. The quote that I'm reading is from the second edition printed by Oxford Press in Oxford University Press in 2000. And he talks about all these different variants, and he says there are more differences among our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. And anytime you hear Bart Ehrman, he will talk about that. Oh, there are hundreds of thousands, and there's only 138,000 words in the New Testament. But the very next sentence in this textbook is this, by Bart Ehrman. He says, in spite of these remarkable differences, scholars are convinced that we can reconstruct the original words of the New Testament, but with reasonable, though probably not 100% accuracy. So in spite of these differences, he includes himself as one of the scholars that recognizes that we can reconstruct the original words of the New Testament with reasonable accuracy. I think that's very important to note, that though detractors make a lot of these differences, it is, as you say, most are not important. And that we can, though, through the work that you do and many New Testament textual critics do, we can know what they are.
Yeah, this is a percentage game.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, Bart Ehrman could never write anything about the text if he didn't have a text to write about.
Yes.
And so he does assume that we have a relatively accurate text, or else he couldn't be writing about it.
That's exactly.
And making commentaries about it and such. There is a difference sometimes that people have about how do we approach the text. And in that sense, we don't take it as a dictation item. The way I like it, it's from someone else, but I've sort of adapted it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to realize that in this world, we don't have God working without us so much as in what's happening, it's God working with us. Mm-hmm. And we don't have us working without God to bring the Bible about. It's us working with God. And so it's God working with fallible humans to bring about his inspired word. And so we're not worried about, we shouldn't get bothered about the fact that if fallible humans are involved, we're going to have to work through differences and get to the text. But we also shouldn't be shaken by it.
Yes.
To where we think, well, if fallible humans are involved, then we can't trust it. Because we also have to remember, there's a perfect God behind it.
Exactly.
That's and a very he's good working point. Through all of this. And right. God can literally hit a straight ball with a crooked stick.
Yes.
And he can use us and still accomplish his purposes. And that's what we see with the Bible.
And that's what we see in the stories of the New Testament and the Old Testament. Yeah. Every believer, every person that follows is very imperfect, as we see. And that's a very good point. And that goes right to why we can trust it as a divinely inspired and given to us. All right, so I would ask this. I'm not even sure that I had mentioned this to you earlier or not, but sometimes detractors will say that these early copyists were just careless, they weren't professional, they just were kind of the guy off the street. What would you say to that about the people that did make the very early copies?
Most of the earliest copies, when Christianity is not legal, and so you do not have the luxury of some of the upper class professional copyists involved, mm-hmm. the ones who work for the upper class. You may have a few, but during that time, it's pretty much Christians making their own copies.
Okay.
Rarely are they going to be able to go to a market or to a library and have a professional make it. If some of those professionals become Christians, you may get professional level copying.
All right.
But they're making good copies.
Yes.
Nobody says they're making bad copies. That really would be outlandish, and the examples would be so minor that that's really not a true statement. Mm-hmm. Are they trained at the highest literary levels? Our text comes from a different social class. Okay. One of the unique things about the New Testament specifically, and not quite as true on the New Testament does not come from the elites and the political leaders. It doesn't come from prophets attached to the royal court.
Yes,
it doesn't
yes.
come from government-sanctified prophets or mm-hmm. spokespeople. It actually comes from common folks. And it gives us an insight into the everyday life of people in ways that virtually no other literature like this from that time period does. But that means also the copies are made in those settings, and they make good copies. They aren't quite as professional as some later.
Sure.
That's why we think most of the differences actually come in the first 2 to 3 centuries of the copying of the text. Because once Christianity becomes legal, you're going to put a more professional copy process
in. I see. That makes sense.
Sometimes along the way, we still had professionals making the copies.
Yes.
It's not like no professionals are involved. But probably these are ones who have come to Christ, mm-hmm. and they're part of the church at that point. Every now and then we'll get an indication that says maybe this was copied in a marketplace by a professional person there, because they'll actually list the lines because they want to be paid for it.
Yes, yes.
And but that's where we have to understand is simply the nature of how Christianity comes about.
Okay.
We are a bottom-up movement. We are not a top-down movement. We don't begin with a government and a nation and an army or anything like that. We begin as common folks, mm-hmm. finding that we have a relationship with God in Christ and is life transforming, and we want copies of the text. The other issue people forget is the literacy issue.
Okay.
A lot of people couldn't read back then. And the literacy rates are probably a little higher than what some books would put them at. But even so, within the Christian community, it's a literary-based movement. We don't have a temple. We don't have
True.
A central context. And one of the German scholars, Udo Schnell, has said it's the most literary-based movement the world has ever seen in that time frame.
That's an interesting statement.
They're writing not just our New Testament. They're writing documents here and there, sending letters back and forth. It's a huge effort on a literary focus. If you get that big a literary focus, they're going to know how to copy text.
That's very interesting.
And
that's
so,
a good thought.
That's where we also see we really don't need to pretend that these are ignorant folks who don't know anything.
Right.
It's a huge literary movement.
Right.
And there's actually a pretty high level of training and sophistication in the Christian movement. Mm-hmm. So the copying of the text would reflect that.
And there were people that were trained to copy documents. That's how I noticed it in the book. They kind of drew a difference between those who copied documents and maybe those who did the calligraphy. But
that's
being
right.
able to copy a document was still a very good skill. They were trained.
That's right. That's
so
right.
It's an interesting
We do book. Have a few manuscripts that are a little more different than others.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, some of the ones that are most different are bilingual Greek Latins.
Okay.
And a lot of that's probably reflecting missionary frontiers as translations are made of the text. And obviously on missionary frontiers, you may not have quite as much sophistication.
I see. Makes sense.
But where Christianity gets established and it's a Greek base, the copies overall are good copies.
Yes. And by the way, Jesus was a Jew. His disciples were Jews, but they, at that time, because of the influence of Alexander the Great, 3 centuries before, everybody dealt with the Greek language, Koine Greek.
In the cities.
In the cities, okay.
That's probably the caveat on that.
Okay.
Is all that
right.
Greek dominates in all of the higher up settings.
All right.
And the urban settings, but a lot of the rural settings are still using their basic languages that they've had for centuries.
Okay.
For example, we think Jesus did most of his teaching in Aramaic, with Hebrew also tagged in. But wait a minute, if everybody's using Greek, why doesn't he do everything in Greek? Well, he probably knew Greek.
Yes.
And most scholars would say that he did, but he's going to use the people's language out in the outlying areas because he's not a city person.
Okay.
He mostly worked small towns, rural settings, and they don't use Greek as their first language there.
Makes sense.
And that's where the missionary expansion goes.
Ah.
And they start reaching these other areas. And so you have to make translations.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Before we run out of time, I want to just go to one last question. And that is about the charge that's often made that these are copies of copies of copies of copies of copies, as if it is the telephone game. And yet, from this book especially, they make the case that just because there is a later manuscript, maybe one in the 900s or the later, doesn't mean it's a less quality manuscript. Explain to us
about this. We have a basic principle, and that's that manuscripts are to be weighed, not counted.
Okay.
We have one manuscript, and it's 9th century, maybe early 10th, but even so. But it seems to be a pretty good copy of a text that we know from early 4th century.
Okay.
And what that means is they either had an in-between manuscript or two, but they had a pretty direct link back into that time period.
Mm-hmm.
They are making copies of copies. That's not our issue.
Right.
We sure are glad they did, or we wouldn't have all these manuscripts.
True.
So actually, that's a positive, not a negative. Did they make good copies is the question.
I see.
The question is not if they make every church around, when they hear, John wrote a gospel, they're going to want a copy of it.
Right.
So
right.
Of course they're making copies. I mean, that's the nature of the movement. We want to have copies of our text. So if they weren't making copies of copies of copies of copies, we wouldn't have Christianity
wouldn't have
like
anything.
We have it today.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're text-based.
Okay.
And I think that's what gets missed by that statement being pushed too much.
Yes.
They're text-based.
Yes.
Did they make good copies is the real issue. Mm-hmm. Not that they made copies. We just give thanks to God they made copies.
Exactly, yeah.
So did they make good copies? And that's where studies have shown that actually they did a pretty amazing job on their copies. Are there some differences? Yes, but that's why we study it.
Mm-hmm.
In order to work through the differences and say, this is a solid text in which we can have confidence, it's reliable for us today.
And that goes back to that embarrassment of riches, that we have so much, and it's been studied to the nth degree in every century. These are not new things that some detractors are saying. These are things we know about. And I think maybe I will close with this question. Since we have so many people that have studied it and so many texts available to us, and yet, isn't it correct to say there hasn't been any upheaval of any doctrine, major doctrine, or our thought about Christianity from this?
A lot of this has to do more with hermeneutics than it does with the manuscripts.
Okay.
From the standpoint, suppose a given manuscript includes a story that others don't or doesn't include it. You never base a major doctrine on one text.
True.
And so the omission or inclusion of a single text, even in a given manuscript, is never decisive for a doctrine. Because if you're basing your doctrine on one single text, you are in a basically flawed hermeneutic. You never base a doctrine on one single text. Major doctrines especially need multiple texts. And so you're never going to see a major doctrine really shaken up by these.
Yes.
Because we don't create doctrines with that type background. You've got to have multiple texts that speak to the issue that the doctrine's addressing.
Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. I appreciate it very much. And I think this is an exciting field that we have so much, and it hasn't undermined anything. In fact, it has made us more confident in what we have in the New Testament. So,
thank you for having me.
Thank you. Appreciate it so much.
Hey, it's Gary and Joe here again. Would you do us a favor?
If you like this podcast, go to iTunes and leave us a review.
This would mean the world to us. Thanks.